From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on your local playground, where a dozen kids are enjoying the spring warmth. Are they wearing masks? Should they be? When the CDC recently announced that vaccinated people need not wear masks indoors anymore, it sparked some confusion for parents and guardians. Most kids are too young to get vaccinated, so what should they do? The CDC has said that kids at summer camps should wear masks, even outdoors, where viral transmission is vanishingly unlikely. Writing for the Atlantic Monthly, Dr. Lucy McBride took up the case that parents should not mask their kids outside. Dr. McBride is an internal medicine physician in Washington, D.C., and the author of a popular COVID newsletter. And she writes, quote, "I've begun telling my patients that their kids, vaccinated or not, do not need to wear masks outside, despite the fact that the CDC recently issued summer camp guidelines that recommend kids wear masks whenever physical distancing is difficult, including outside. I know that parents in some communities get dirty looks at the playground if they let their kids run around without masks, but doing so is not a sign of recalcitrance. It's a sign that they are following the science," end quote. So what exactly is the science? That's one of the issues we've asked Dr. McBride to address with us this hour. She also writes about the fear that some Americans have expressed about returning to something close to normal. If you, like me, felt a little naked the first time you walked through a store without a mask on since the start of the pandemic, this conversation is for you as well. And we'll address some of the points recently raised by Brown University economist Emily Oster, who has been an advocate for allowing children to participate in most of their pre-pandemic activities. But Oster says the CDC botched the public messaging on this. She writes, quote, "The CDC needs to give anxious parents more clarity. And because vaccines are now readily available to adults, I would encourage the CDC to start talking about kids with a focus on the risk to kids. Throughout the pandemic, health authorities have noted that most kids are at low risk of serious illness, but they have argued nevertheless that all kids need to take precautions to protect adults. Not to put too fine a point on it, but we have burdened our children for the sake of our society, and particularly the oldest members of our society. Now that the great majority of adults can protect themselves through vaccination, this burden no longer makes sense," end quote. So what does make sense? Let me welcome our guest for the hour, Dr. Lucy McBride, a practicing internal medicine physician in Washington, D.C., contributor to The Atlantic, publisher of a COVID newsletter, and really someone that I've turned to many times, just I think for some thoughtful clarity throughout this past year. Dr. McBride, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Evan, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be with you today.
Well, let's just start with sort of the fear of returning to normal. I don't know if the term you would use is sort of reentry anxiety or fear of returning to normal, but how prevalent do you think that is? And what is, generally speaking, your approach to that?
Let's get right to it. I actually coined a term in the spring for this very phenomenon called FONO, fear of normal. I have three teenagers, and they talk about fear of missing out. And what I'm noticing is this new phenomenon in my patients. I see patients every day in my office. I'm a primary care doctor, helping people manage the fears and facts of COVID-19 along with their underlying medical conditions. After a 15-month extended period of stress, unrest, and what I'm calling collective trauma, it's normal to have ambivalence and a mixed set of emotions as we face reentry, even if your pandemic experience was somehow better in ways. But for most people, you know, the pandemic has brought a lot of loss, whether you've lost a loved one, you've lost a job, you've lost your high school in-person experience. We've all experienced loss and stress. We've all had to pivot to a completely different life. And now that we have the opportunity to re-enter life, it is posing some challenges. It's just because the CDC guidance changed on a dime doesn't mean that our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors change that quickly. We're human.
Well, and you wrote recently about just how much you're seeing from this. Let me read from another piece that you wrote. You wrote, quote, "I'm a primary care doctor. Every day I'm witnessing the emotional, behavioral, physical, and medical fallout of the pandemic. The stacked traumas of COVID-19 are making us sick. The accumulated stress in my patients' lives has naturally informed how they think, feel, and behave. Grief and loss have directly affected their medical decision-making and health. Widespread vaccination is our ticket to normalcy, but no one is immune to the trauma of the pandemic, end quote. So knowing that, Dr. McBride, do you urge empathy for example, let's say some listeners are thinking, what's the big deal? Let's get on with it. Let's get back to normal. And
right,
and yet there's someone in their life who is vaccinated but still doesn't feel safe in a grocery store without a mask, or doesn't feel safe indoors anywhere without a mask. Do you urge kind of empathy and patience with that?
Absolutely. I mean, let's just be real. We have been through so much together. We've all experienced different levels of stress along different axes. We've experienced enormous political unrest during the same time, ongoing racial injustice, and a global pandemic that has taken nearly 600,000 American lives. We need to give each other a little latitude as we adjust to, you know, post-pandemic life. We need to give ourselves a little break and not be too hard on ourselves as we really navigate this new, quote, normal. I put it in quotes because, you know, there are a lot of things about normal we don't want to bring back. There are a lot of parts of my life. There are a lot of parts of my patient's life. There are a lot of parts of American life that I think we need to really think hard and sort of reimagine, like, for example, healthcare or, you know, the conversation about race in this country. I mean, there's so many things we need to roll up our sleeves right now for the vaccine and roll up our sleeves to get to work, to really, really think about what it means to be healthy, what it means to be human. My thesis in my practice for 20 years has always been that humans are complex, layered organisms. We are, you know, we are not just a set of boxes to check, that we bring our lived experiences to our everyday lives and thoughts and the way people behave. And that, therefore, informs our physical outcomes. It also informs our medical health. So in that piece you just quoted, what I'm talking about is that mental and physical health are inseparable. We all have mental health. It's part of the human condition. It's part of the deal. You can't opt out of having mental health like you can a feature on your iPhone. So when we are dealing with a collective trauma, when people are physically and emotionally distressed, and the bodily dysfunction that comes with that is being played out in real time, it's only appropriate at this moment, this watershed moment in the pandemic, to really think about the intersection of mental and physical health, how to help people, you know, recover from trauma, and how to help them help themselves from the ground up.
So let me let listeners know here just briefly, as we go throughout this hour, if you've got thoughts to share on sort of fear of normal, FONO, as Dr. McBride says.
FONO.
about the mental stress that you feel. You know, are you comfortable walking around a grocery store without a mask on right now? I will, you know, sort of be honest that today I got to work, and for the first time in, like, I don't know, since April of last year probably, I realized I did not have a mask in my car. And so I walked up to my office, no mask. We don't have to have them on here in the building. We're following CDC guidelines. Some people still do, and I mostly still have, just sort of out of the habit. But I didn't, and it kind of felt weird, but it felt good in a way, and it felt strange in a way. But I guess I would like to hear how people are dealing with that.
Sure.
And if you're feeling anxiety, so listeners, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And we'll take some of your feedback on the concept of the stress of FONO, of fear of normal, and how we're sort of moving through those spaces. But let's talk a little bit more about kids here. Because when you say,
and
I know you probably don't write the headlines. You probably write the piece, but not the headlines. But the headline said, you know, don't mask your kids outside. It's blunt. So take us through why you make that recommendation.
Well, here's the fact. And, you know, it's funny when you talk about unmasking, some people accuse you of being anti-mask. Absolutely not. I was masked up when it made sense scientifically and from all the medical data. But when the risk of outdoor transmission of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, is so tiny, I mean, the risk of transmitting person to person in a casual encounter outside is close to zero. I mean, can it happen? Sure. Are there exceptions? Yes. If you had unvaccinated people crowded around like a sandbox, and one of them happened to have asymptomatic COVID or symptomatic COVID, I guess, if they were let outside with symptoms, and they could they transmit it? Sure. But it's just not happening in enough quantity to justify masking outside. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, nature is our friend. It always has been. Moreover, you know, my job is about risk assessment, thinking about the harms of doing versus the harms of not doing, the harms of action versus the harms of inaction. When the emotional and social benefits of getting outside, unmasking, seeing the broad range of expressions in people's faces, particularly for kiddos who have been really experiencing a unique set of traumas, when those are so huge and the risk of outdoor transmission so infinitesimally small, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer to take masks off. Of course, there are people who will want to continue to mask, and they should be able to. We should be kind to people who want to mask outside because they may have a unique condition. They may have some anxiety, and that is their right, and that's fine. But it shouldn't be mandated to be masking outside, particularly for kiddos who really need some freedoms after this long haul.
So let's talk a little bit more about relative risk then, because when you say risk assessment is a big part of what you do, I mean, I'm sure I picked a field where I was promised there would be no math, and yet math always hunts me down and I always screw it up. And so what I tried to really do throughout the last 14 months is patiently listen to people who understand the risk assessment better. And one of the things that I don't think has been helpful is the idea that well, the chances aren't zero. People will say, like, well, you know, if you get vaccinated, you can still spread the virus. And I say, extremely unlikely. And they say, yeah, but it's possible.
Sure.
You know, or, you know, kids could get sick if they're outside. They get infected outside. I'd say, yeah, it's extremely unlikely. And they say, yeah, but isn't it possible? Well, it's almost like it's a trump card. And the answer is, yes, it's possible. But can you take me through what it means to say it's possible, and then make choices that limit behavior as a result?
Sure. So this is actually the essence of the practice of medicine, is really helping people understand risk and relative risk, marry the data with their unique medical conditions, and help people make smart decisions for their unique health situation and goals. So, you know, there's risk everywhere. It's risky being a human being. I mean, if I was going to tack down risk to zero for my patients, I would tell them, don't drive a car, don't get in a swimming pool, don't have a sexual relationship with anybody. You know, oh, by the way, maybe you don't want to leave your house because, you know, you could get mugged, you could have a tree fall on your head on the way to the supermarket. In other words, risk is everywhere. Being a human involves undertaking risk. And so my job in my patient care space is to help people understand what is an immediate threat, what is a potential long-term threat, like a chronic disease. If you don't manage your blood pressure, then you might develop a stroke. And then what is the harm of an action, like a medication, versus a harm of inaction, like not putting you on the medication and picking a different path, like lifestyle modification for blood pressure. So the same rubric applies when you're making broad public health recommendations, and then it applies in a pandemic when I'm guiding specific patients on what to do. Should you go to that workplace? Should you, you know, take your mask off in an indoor space when you've been vaccinated? At the end of the day, Evan, it's about explaining the facts to patients and to the broad general public. It's about empowering people with nuanced guidance and giving them hard data so they can, in my office, understand the risks of doing and the risks of not doing. So take, for example, vaccination. When you have been vaccinated with a COVID-19 vaccine, one of the three vaccines that is currently available, which are really triumphs of modern medicine, I don't use the word miracle because that has like a religious overtone and there's nothing religious about it. It's pure science and really mm-hmm. the most phenomenal vaccines we've ever seen. When you've been vaccinated, the chance of getting COVID-19 is very, very small. Any symptomatic COVID-19, it's hard to get COVID after you've been vaccinated. Can you get COVID? Sure. But you're going to have a milder illness. You're not going to go to the hospital. You're not going to die. Is it possible to die after getting vaccinated? Sure, but it's just not happening. You also are not going to transmit the virus to other people. So once you've been vaccinated, it is, as I'm encouraging my patients to do, okay to liberalize your life. Unmask indoors, see other people with the understanding that there's nothing in life that's zero risk.
Yeah, I mean, and I think some of that comes back to media coverage, and here's what I mean by that.
Yeah.
If I were to write a story today with the following headline, it would be factually true. If the headline was "Car brakes can fail," it would be true.
Oh, yeah.
It would be true. Car brakes can fail.
It would be true.
But the headline would affect people in a way that would make them think, "Wow, they could fail more than I thought, or a lot, or I should rethink driving." Car brakes can fail. Thank goodness they rarely fail. And thank goodness if they do fail, we're hopefully equipped to try to deal with and survive the crash. But that headline would be true. In the same way that we see, you know, kids outside can get COVID. Well, I guess they can, but it's the same kind of thing here. But that headline, I think, is what moves. And I think, well-intended journalists, I'm not somebody who's sitting here saying, you know, the media is lazy or they're hacking. I think they really meant well, especially when we were trying to figure out if you get vaccinated, can you still spread the virus, et cetera. But I think we got obsessed with the notion of zero. And as Dr. Steph Burrell said on this program, we're not going to COVID zero. It's not going to happen. And we need to stop obsessing with zero risk or zero COVID. How do you see it?
100%. And I completely admire and respect Steph Burrell. He's right. I mean, there is an ocean of gray between this kind of zero COVID posture in public health and the let it rip posture, where it's just like, well, let's just let COVID run its course and, you know, take the lives of people unnecessarily. There's an ocean of gray there, and that's where nuance matter. That's where, you know, people need one at a time in the doctor's office and then in broad guidance from the CDC, facts and information that evolve as the public health landscape evolves. You're right, Evan. We need journalists. We need the media. You know, democracy dies in darkness. We are absolutely in need of stories and coverage of everything that's happening. At the same time, fear headlines sell. And we have seen an unfortunately disproportionate amount of reporting on the pandemic that is negative. David Leonhardt and the New York Times have done a really nice job of reporting and also talking about bad news bias. So the unfortunate reality of the bad news bias that has happened and continues to happen, like talking about variants and fourth waves and all that, which is, of course, possible, but isn't happening, is that it affects people's day-to-day existence. I mean, that's what I'm seeing play out in my patients. I mean, I'm literally watching people afraid, scared, not living their life, not meeting their broad human needs because they are so afraid of variants and the fourth wave, when the fact of the matter is, yes, we have variants, but they are not evading the immune protection from the current vaccines. And it's just not something, it's not an immediate threat. So we should worry about the more immediate threats, like your mental health, your ability to convene with your mother in the nursing home, which you can do safely. So the headlines really matter. They really, really matter, as you know. I mean, you're in the media, and that's why I've been writing this newsletter for 15 months, separate fact from fear.
It's so good. And, you know, I'm just so grateful for it, Dr. McBride. And that's why it was such
nice.
Well, I mean, that's why it was such a thrill. I mean, honestly, you know, there's so many of your colleagues who, of course, I wouldn't have known of your work before the pandemic. But I'm thrilled to be able to engage with you because you communicate so well. And you communicate, I think, with empathy.
Tell my husband that. No, I'm kidding. I'm like, hey, did you do the dishes? But thank you. I mean, you know, I have always appreciated communication. You know, that's one thing that is part of the essence of medicine is communicating to patients. I don't look at my job as like I'm on a podium and sort of lecturing to my patients. I look at it as a partnership. You know, here I am delivering facts, giving you nuanced guidance. And, you know, it's up to you as to what path you want to take. And here are the options. I have a little study. I have a little experience, and I have a little training that you might want to be aware of and take advantage of. And so here's the deal. And there, there are, again, risks everywhere you go. So communication really, really matters. That's how we, you know, empower patients. It also really matters in the public health space. And when communications are really slanting towards the negative, and for example, right now, you know, emboldening this narrative that kids are not safe to be unmasked at camp, or that, you know, we're going to have kids masked in school in August and September. I mean, it's just, it's not rooted in science, and it's also terrifying parents, and it's causing kids a lot of distress. I'm a mother. I also see adolescents as patients, and, you know, there have been a number of suicides in this area. There have been suicides, across the country. The risk of suicide is higher than the risk for, you know, severe illness from COVID-19. So we really need, in kids, we really need to put these risks in perspective. And as I've been saying for 20 years, put mental health in the doctor's office. It is time to put mental health, our lived experience, and our whole person in the doctor's office. And then, by the way, reimagine healthcare in this country, where every American has unfettered access to a primary care doctor, where you can have mental and physical health woven together. Because at the end of the day, if you're stressed, anxious, depressed, traumatized, grieving, and you're not having those things addressed, you're not any healthier by just checking the boxes, checking your cholesterol and your weight and moving along. See you next year.
Before I grab some phone calls and emails from listeners, if you're on the phone, hang there. I've got some emails to read. But just to kind of put a fine point on a couple of the things you just mentioned, you mentioned summer camps, you mentioned schools. Now, the CDC is still recommending that not only kids, but vaccinated camp counselors wear masks outdoors. And
it doesn't make sense.
You know, you and, you know, your colleagues like Emily Oster and others have said, come on. But can you take me through your thoughts on camps? And then you mentioned schools. Indoor in the classroom, let's say we don't have more vaccine availability or eligibility for kids starting in September, October, when kids are back in the classroom. Do you think they need to be masked in the classroom? So let's start with camps and then transition to schools if you could.
Sure. So when you've been vaccinated, as you know, 16-year-olds and above have been able to do for a couple of weeks now, and now we have the 12 to 15-year-old crowd able to be vaccinated. When you've been vaccinated, your chance again of getting COVID-19 is very, very low. You're not going to die. You're not going to transmit it to other people. Is it possible? Sure. It's just not likely. And outdoors is safe. So it just doesn't make sense for a vaccinated person to be wearing a mask outside. I mean, it also poses harm, right? It can be dangerous to be wear a mask on a 90-degree day playing, you know, basketball with your buddies. It's not rooted in science. At the same time, I just want to say, you know, the CDC, like, I do not envy Rochelle Walensky's position. She was a couple years ahead of me at Harvard Medical School and actually trained at Johns Hopkins, where I did my residency training. I have immense respect for her. She is reaching the widest audience and is having to speak to people who don't believe in COVID, and then having to speak to people who are cowering in fear after vaccination and not living their lives. So, you know, I think it's a hard job. I also think the CDC should give more nuanced guidance for kids right now, because kids are not vaccinated, right? The ones who are 11 and under, they are the ones who have suffered uniquely in the pandemic from restrictions. And I am arguing, and have been arguing with a chorus of people and colleagues beating the drum on Twitter and in general, that the pandemic restrictions on kids, the harms of pandemic restrictions, greatly outweigh the potential harm of COVID-19 in this age group. And so we need the CDC to give, as Emily, my friend and pal, Emily Oster, has said, we need the CDC to really issue more nuanced guidance for camps and for schools, because the science has evolved, but more importantly, the data are clear that it's safe to be outside. And even once we get to the school year in the fall, you know, by fall, I mean, we're going to be in a completely different landscape in the fall, with so many adults being vaccinated, so many more so much more progress in terms of lowering case rates and hospitalizations, that kids are indirectly protected by being around vaccinated adults. So we look at the UK and Israel as, you know, a couple months ahead of us. We saw, and we're seeing in the United States right this minute, that as you vaccinate adults, case rates drop, and case rates drop in kids. In other words, protecting an adult in the United States or anywhere protects kids as well. So by the time we get to August, there really isn't going to be a need for masking kids inside, even if they're unvaccinated.
3 months from now, you think the pandemic is going to be largely wiped out in this country? I mean, maybe we're not going to zero, but very, very low case rates.
Right. And look, I am not claiming to have a crystal ball. I mean, that would be really, really handy if I did. But I don't have a crystal ball. Like, you know, could the global situation of the pandemic, for example, what's happening in India, generate variants, which it could if it continues to be, you know, on fire like it is so tragically? Could that generate variants that then come to the United States and threaten, you know, our amazing progress that we have the luxury of making because we have so much vaccine? Sure, which is, you know, again, we could talk about global equity and vaccines if we want to, but my point is, could things change? Absolutely. But if things go as they are now, which we hope they will, that the pandemic will be in the rearview mirror. The trauma that we've experienced will still be with us. I mean, there's going to be reverberations for decades, particularly for young people, I think. You know, there's something called post-traumatic stress we all have heard of. We will all experience that in some way, shape, or form. There's also post-traumatic growth where you can, you know, make meaning out of a stressful and horrible time. But, you know, those things have lasting, the traumas like this have lasting effects on people's mental and physical health. So while we will see the pandemic go away and it will be, and COVID will be endemic, which is meaning it just floating around and, you know, like other viruses, we will see an ongoing epidemic of despair. You know, we had diseases of despair pre-pandemic booming: opiate addiction, suicide, depression, anxiety. I mean, you know, it's not like it was a picnic in the United States before the pandemic. Then you put, you know, a global pandemic, layer that on to the despair we were already experiencing, of course, in different ways, according to different people and different populations. And then, you know, we can't expect, even when COVID goes away, to feel mentally and physically well. And again, I wrote a piece for MedPage last week, an editorial about, you know, primary care. I'm a little biased, of course, but I think primary care needs to be reinvented to help people dig out from trauma, to help them with their mental and physical health, because, you know, this is real, and COVID may go away in important ways, but the trauma is not.
Talking to Dr. Lucy McBride, a practicing internal medicine physician in Washington, D.C., a contributor to The Atlantic, among other publications, and the creator of her own COVID newsletter, which has become a vital resource for so many. If you're on the phone, we'll take it right after this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we've been talking a lot about the mayoral campaign in Rochester, city council as well. There are school board races, 9 candidates. And we will be bringing them to you in extended conversations, helping you prepare for the June 22nd elections, a chance to get to know the candidates, and to vote with knowledge of what they would do in office. It's coming your way Tuesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and on the phone, this is Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Good. Very good. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm a little different from what I've heard so far. The mask was never an inconvenience for me. You just put the mask on, you go. I have stopped wearing them in my apartment at home. That's a big step. And I wore them all the time that I was in the hospital. And everybody kept asking me, why? And I kept trying to abbreviate it and just say, I have other problems. And I do not want to get this. But they keep warning us about variants, and I've heard that if you've had the vaccination, that it's possible that some of that will help you with the variants. But that's sort of a gray area to me. I intend to continue wearing them when I go grocery shopping and other places. I've had people sneeze on me not wearing a mask. Mm. So it's been, you know, you never know what you'll run into. And it just doesn't bother me. So for me, it wouldn't be a problem to wear it or to not wear it. But I just, you've talked already about the variants a little bit, but and what's going on in India. You hear these things that are just unbelievably tragic. And I heard also a month ago, I guess it was, that they're already getting ready for the next pandemic because this is going to be the way it's going to be. Mm. I think they're kind of speaking ahead of time. But we know, we certainly learned some lessons with this. We need to get right on it and get busy with it instead of saying it'll be over at Easter. You know, well, thank you very much. It didn't happen. But anyway, I just wanted, I feel like I'm just one thinking.
Well, Jane, much love to you. Thank you for the phone call, and good luck to you. And so there's a couple points from Jane there. Let's start on the subject of variants. Dr. McBride, my understanding is that so far, so good. In other words, yes, there could eventually be a future variant that evades the vaccine's protection, but so far, so good. Is that how you see it?
So far, so good, 100%. So far, so good. So when I say 100%, it doesn't mean that there's a 100% guarantee that you're not going to get a cold or a mild respiratory illness if you get COVID. But that's not because of a variant. That's just because vaccines are not 100% perfect. These are pretty close. These vaccines we have are pretty close. But remember, perfect was never on the menu. So the point, though, that Jane is asking, or the question she's asking, is such a good one, because the stories of the variants are what's driving a lot of anxiety. I should also say, you know, Jane, if you want to mask up in the grocery store because that makes you feel comfortable and you're not bothered by it, absolutely, you should do that. That is your right, and no one should harass you or bug you or even ask you why you're doing that, because that's your personal decision, right? I mean, we do what we have to do. At the same time, as I counsel my patients every day, you want to make sure that your decisions are rooted in facts and rooted in science, because, you know, if you are not going to get sick from the virus, most likely, and you've been vaccinated, then you have to think about why you're wearing the mask, because, you know, you might just be masking forever, because COVID, again, is going to be with us for a long time, like, you know, the sort of wimpy coronaviruses that have been in existence and circulating for years. I mean, you and I, Evan, have had coronaviruses, I don't know, 5-6 times, mm-hmm. the common cold. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sort of like, well, yes, wear a mask, but also make sure that you understand that there's, you know, you might get sick of it in a couple of years and you might want to abandon it. But yeah, the reason you would need a booster shot is if somehow the virus was given enough of an opportunity to spread and then mutate and then outsmart the immune protection from the current vaccines. It just has not happened. It has not happened. Moreover, we are choking the virus's ability every single day to find hosts and infect them and mutate. I mean, if you look at the curves, right, the case rates are dropping, hospitalization rates are dropping, and the virus is having a harder and harder time to find people to infect. So I don't have a crystal ball, but I think it's hard to imagine that in the United States we would have a variant that would escape immune protection. But I also don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, and it could happen.
Well, so let's hit a couple of emails if we could. Andrew writes and says, Evan, how does your guest explain the debacle on the New York Yankees? Andrew, I'm glad you asked that, because that, you know, interestingly enough, I was probably like you, Andrew, when I first saw the headline, what was it, 7 or 8 New York Yankees, including a third base coach, got COVID after they were vaccinated, I think with J&J. And It turns out the math is, this is a success story. And Dr. McBride, you want to take it from
is.
There?
Can you tell I'm excited to talk about this?
Yes.
People saw that headline and thought, oh, crap, I've been vaccinated. And now the Yankees have been vaccinated and they got sick. So this is terrible. And I'm gonna be worried. So that's normal to feel like that, right? We've been in a fear-based mindset for so long. But the truth of the matter is this. That story is a vaccine success story. Here is the real detail that matters. It was 8 Yankees and staff members who tested positive for COVID-19. Only one of them was actually sick and had a very mild, self-limited cold. It's important to realize that we are not recommending, I do not recommend, nor do most people who understand the landscape of COVID testing, we should not be testing people who do not have symptoms who've been vaccinated with a PCR test. In other words, these 7 Yankees and staff members who tested positive for coronavirus after vaccination, who did not get sick, that was a positive test. That doesn't mean they were sick. The definition of COVID-19 is symptomatic infection with SARS-CoV-2. In other words, let me make it even more simple. It was a positive test problem, not a COVID problem. Had those people not been vaccinated, someone could have died. Someone could have been at the hospital. Someone could have gotten sick. It wouldn't have maybe been just one of them getting sick. It would have been a lot of them getting sick. And by the way, it was a group of 50 or 60 people who were in dugouts and clubhouses and mingling, and it was only 7 who tested positive, or 8. In other words, let's stop testing people with the PCR test after they've been vaccinated, because if you have a positive test, but you're not sick yourself and your viral load in your nose is so tiny that you are very unlikely to infect someone else, we don't necessarily need to know that information. Does that make sense?
Yes, like, because what you are saying,
like, just because we can doesn't mean we should. It doesn't mean you shouldn't think about PCR testing at some point, because everything is different case by case.
Yeah.
And unvaccinated people still should be tested with PCR testing because it's very sensitive. But it's too sensitive a test for vaccinated asymptomatic people.
Asymptomatic. Dr. McBride is not saying who cares if you're vaccinated and get COVID. She's saying a positive test when you have a very low viral load and almost certainly can't transmit, it doesn't do anybody any good, because all of a sudden you get that test and what happens? Well, now you're sitting out of your job for 2 weeks. You're not.
That's it.
You're withdrawing from society for another couple of weeks, but you are vaccinated,
right,
and you are not sick and you are not transmitting. So,
right. Like, I'm hearing of these kids who are the kids of my patients who had to step out of school for 2 weeks after they had, you know, they were 16 and they had a positive test because the school was still doing surveillance. They had to sit out of school for another 2 weeks. This kid had a day back in school in person. And I mean, it's just not necessary. So again, there's nuance. There are unique situations, and that's why I hopefully will always have a job. but in general, it doesn't make sense to test asymptomatic vaccinated people with a PCR test. And that's what the story of the Yankees was. Vaccine success. Let's think hard about testing. Just because we can doesn't mean we should.
Andrew, thank you for that. I'm really glad to get that from him. Here's Denise, who says, Evan, the doctor you currently have on the air made a finite, conclusive statement that hasn't been proven yet about vaccinated people not being able to contract and transmit the virus. As far as I know, from all the reading I've done, that's not conclusive yet. There have also been... There have been reported, she goes on to say, there have been reported cases of post-vaccinated people transmitting. She might want to correct this statement as it's dangerous. Let's remember those of us who have... children or underlying conditions. That's from Denise.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. So I've had patients who have been vaccinated who had COVID. They have been a breakthrough case. Yes, it is possible. It's just very, very, very unlikely. If you look at the real world data, if you look at the world stage, the risk of getting COVID-19, which again is possible after vaccination, is just so small. It's something around the order of, it depends on which study you're looking at, 0.005% and 0.0005%. In other words, yes, you can get breakthrough cases. There have been reported cases, and the CDC is documenting those, thankfully, because we need to know about those. There is nothing about me that is blasé about COVID-19. I've had patients die from COVID-19. I've had patients' family members die from COVID-19. It is a lethal virus, but once you have been vaccinated, your chance of getting symptomatic COVID-19 is very, very small. Your chance of transmitting it is also very, very small. Is it possible? Yes. Similarly, you can get COVID after vaccination. It's just so darn unlikely.
Yeah, and I think that's why maybe I use too much of a shorthand of that idea that you just heard from Dr. McBride. Listeners, because they'll hear me say, you know, if you get vaccinated, you're not going to spread it. Well, that is true for the vast, vast, vast majority of people. If you are, when you have literally hundreds of millions of people getting vaccinated, you are going to have outlier stories,
sure,
and outlier cases. Now, on that subject, Dr. McBride, you will have people, and I'm sure you've heard this. I mean, Emily Oster has been very, I think, public about some of the rough kind of feedback she gets sometimes from people who are saying, you know, you don't care about kids, you don't care about safety. People can be really rough about this when you say, don't mask kids outside, let kids be kids, let kids have a normal summer. People get very angry. And so when people say, okay, you're right, kids handle COVID pretty well, most kids aren't even symptomatic, but there are hundreds of millions of kids who could get it, and it, you only need a few cases. You know, there's a few kids who've died from this. You know, isn't that enough to convince us not to take that risk? What do you think?
Well, I think that, and this is why, again, I have a job. I have patients who have been vaccinated who have not mounted a robust antibody response and who are naturally afraid of COVID still. Although we have to remember that the immune system is extremely nimble and vast, and it doesn't hinge only on antibodies. But the point is that, yes, there are vulnerable people because of medical conditions, immunosuppressed patients. I have a liver transplant patient who is very susceptible to COVID, even though she's been vaccinated. There are kids with special needs who, you know, have first of all, suffered extraordinarily during the pandemic, but also are at higher risk for COVID-19, kids with underlying health conditions that put them at higher risk. So, no, I mean, as a physician, as a practicing physician who cares for, you know, a large flock of patients, I have 100% respect for everybody's unique medical situation. I have 100% respect for COVID-19. I mean, talk about fear. I mean, you should have seen me back in March 2020, which is why I started trying to help a wider audience, because, you know, we're all afraid of this virus. At the same time, it's always important to put things in context. It's important to put risk in context, to frame risk and to realize that, you know, health, again, is more than the absence of disease. It's important not to get a virus like COVID-19, especially if you're unvaccinated and high risk. It's also important to reach our broad human needs, to be able to socialize, connect with other people, to go to work, to go to school. Those are essential, fundamental parts of the human condition. Part of the reason kids have suffered so much is not necessarily because they're worried about getting COVID. If they are looking at the data themselves, they realize that the risk of COVID-19 to children is very, very small. But yes, kids have died, of course, tragically. The kids are suffering mostly because they are not able to engage in their regular lives. Kids need school for their social emotional development. Kids in this country, unfortunately, need school for safety. They need it for food. So again, health is defined as, you know, emotional, physical, social health and well-being. It's not just about not getting a cold.
The whole person.
It's the whole person, right? I mean,
just as you wrote about from MedPage Today, the whole person.
That's right. It's the whole person. Now, you know, the good news here, Evan, is we can have both. We can be mentally and physically healthy together. We can tack down the risk of getting COVID-19 in a high-risk person and help them go back to work and go back to school. So it's not an either-or. You know, we need less buts and more ands. It's not mutually exclusive. You know, being optimistic about post-vaccination life and being cautious and careful, as I am a person am and I as a physician am, are possible to do in tandem. In other words, I can help my patients mitigate the risk, but they can also go to work. I can help my patients, you know, go to camp or be a summer camp counselor and not get COVID. So we can do both. It's just that you need a guide and you need a doctor and you need, you know, trusted guides in your community. So you know, being human is hard. It's hard in a pandemic, but again, we need to realize there's risk everywhere, and there's risk of doing and risk of not doing.
Andy writes to say, is the Yankee situation like saying just because you're positive for HPV doesn't mean you'll develop cancer?
Yes, 100%. Well, you know what? Let me take back the word 100%, because, you know, there's no perfect analogy, but it's you could say that's a good analogy. Having a positive test is not the same as having a disease. The difference there, obviously, with HPV is if you test positive for HPV and you don't treat it, it could develop into cancer. I mean, the odds are it wouldn't, but you could. Whereas a positive PCR test in an asymptomatic vaccinated person is not going to develop into COVID-19, if you wait that full 10 days. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And Andy, I think you're just looking for a useful parallel. Just think of it.
Yes.
Just think of it like the math worked here. I mean, we knew that if you get J&J, you've got maybe a 1 in 3 chance of quote unquote getting COVID if you are exposed to a significant viral load. That doesn't mean a serious case, just means sort of a milder case of COVID. And it turns out that is almost exactly the number. I mean, it was amazing how close it tracked. That Yankee story
right. Should
give us a lot of confidence.
And the other piece of that story that is interesting, Evan, is that, you know, there's a New England Journal of Medicine study that came out last week, I think it was, showing that, you know, the efficacy and the robustness of the immune response after the J&J is probably more like at 4 weeks than 2 weeks. So, you know, I took the Yankee story, read it, you know, carefully like most people, and then saw that New England Journal of Medicine article. And I'm now recommending to my J&J vaccine recipients, you know, before you go, you know, prancing around with other, you know, vaccinated people indoors, just wait 4 weeks. Because, again, you can be cautious like I am with my patients and also, you know, allow people to reach their broad human needs. Those are not mutually exclusive.
So one other point I want to hit that, you know, Jane mentioned, and I want to explain, like when Jane on the phone was talking about sort of the inevitability of future pandemics, and I kind of recoiled. I didn't mean to recoil, Jane, because there won't be future pandemics. I mean, eventually there will. I hope we don't live in fear that it's right around the corner and that it's going to be worse or the same, and that we'll never sort of develop a regular flow of life again. Eventually there will be more. I mean, that's the nature of the world we live in. If you look at history, what I hope is that we've learned a lot of really valuable lessons and that we're going to get,
let's talk about that.
We're going to get better at that. So what's the most valuable lesson, Dr. McBride, that you've seen us learning or that we should be learning from this?
Oh my gosh, there's so many lessons. And if you've had the luxury of the brain space to think about it, you might really think hard and drill down into what it means to be healthy and what it means to be human. As a practicing physician and being privileged to care for patients for 20 years and really seeing the whole person and the human condition unfold, you know, I've realized, like most primary care doctors do, that people are so complex. People have so many genetic, environmental, social, emotional, physical, medical, you know, sort of elements that unfortunately in modern healthcare are not fully seen or acknowledged or addressed. So one thing that I've realized in sort of the field of medicine and practice of medicine is how very desperately on the heels of a collective trauma, people need trusted guides. It doesn't have to be even a doctor, some primary care provider. It doesn't even have to be a medical person, but people need trusted guides. They need someone who can speak the truth, who is not afraid to go against the current of the public narrative if it's not rooted in facts. And they need someone to help steer them towards better mental and physical health. You know, I think that primary care is beautifully situated to play that role as we reimagine healthcare in this country. Primary care doctors are uniquely situated to be a hub for problem solving and not just a gatekeeping apparatus. On a personal level, what I've reflected on is just like what I reflect on with my patients, is what I need to be healthy. And this is what I try to practice what I preach. You know, I need sleep. I need exercise. It doesn't have to be fancy. I'm not training for any marathon anytime soon. But, you know, good sleep, routine movement, 3 decent meals a day. I need to connect with my friends and my family. I need to have the contours of regular life to feel healthy. And I need to ask for help too. When I am struggling or when I have needs that I can't meet myself, which is normal, you ask for help. So those are the things I've reflected on quite a lot. Those are the things that I talk with my kids about, whether they like it or not at the dinner table, is like asking for assistance, asking for help is a strength. And to think about what it is you need in your everyday life, not just when you show up at the doctor's once a year, but in your everyday life, what do you need to feel healthy? It's also about finding meaning, finding purpose. And for me, educating a wider audience about the role of mental health in our whole health has been extremely gratifying, because at the end of the day, everyone can relate. We're all human.
Where do people find more of your work, Dr. McBride?
You can find my website is where you can find all of the media and publications, www.lucymcbride.com. You can sign up for my newsletter there. And you can find me in D.C. kicking around, walking my dog with my kids, and, you know, trying to do the best I can in a crazy time.
You're a phenomenal communicator, and I think you're helping a lot of people. And it's been a thrill for me to finally get a chance to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time, Dr. McBride.
Evan, thanks so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Dr. Lucy McBride, a valuable follow. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson, saying have a wonderful afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.